and thanks for tuning in to the 10th and Broad Church of Christ podcast. This episode is presented by preaching minister Josh Yeager. Let's tune in now for Josh's message.
So if you would reach underneath your seat, there should be a test stuck underneath the seat, and you'll have to take it out, and your points for today will count on how you... No, just kidding. No test today. I heard some people joking about Josh is going to give us a test. My dad was telling me that. So I'm a horrible test taker. Any other bad test takers in the room? Any bad test takers in the room? Okay, there's a few of you. We can join a support group sometime, maybe. I'm a really bad test taker, and I have this tendency when I take a test to just forget everything that I've learned. How many people have that issue? You're about to take that test, and it's like you've been studying, and you know it, and you get to the test, and you're so panicked, and you're in such a frenzy that you just forget everything that you've ever learned, and it's like, oh my goodness, this is all brand new to me. I'm in trouble. I also have this problem when I take tests. I overthink every single question. I overthink it. Instead of just doing my gut, my gut feeling, I overthink it. I think, man, this teacher's trying to, trick me or doing something like that. And I remember, especially on the ACT, I did particularly awful in math on the ACT, and the thing about it was that I took lots of math in high school. I mean, I took Algebra 1, I took Algebra 2, I took Geometry, I took what was called Advanced Math at my school, which was basically Trig and Pre-Cal. I did not take Calculus, but I took lots of math, and I took the hard classes, and I remember getting to the ACT on my senior year, and I just remember looking at the questions and just being like, I don't remember anything, and I did so poorly on the math section of the ACT that I had to take remedial math at OC because I did so poorly on the math. I took it twice. I did that poorly both times. I did so bad that I had to take remedial math. And the funny thing about that remedial class was that it was one of those classes that you basically had to show up in the computer lab with an instructor, but you could do your work anytime because it was all online. And so I actually showed up. I finished the class in 2 weeks because it was so easy. It was like nothing that, it's all stuff that I'd done before. It was super simple, but I just stink at taking tests, and so I had to take it. But if you're like me, tests can kind of get frustrating. How many people you just hate that test day, man? I hate test day. They can get frustrating, but they are also very important. When you have a test, tests are very important. They show you what you need to work on. They also show your instructor how they can better instruct you, how they can better teach you. Of course, ACT doesn't really work that way. But most other tests work that way. They show your instructor the things that they need to do to maybe make their teaching better or how they can help their class understand a concept better. And so this testing is very important. And the thing about this world is that tests are just a part of life. I mean, you got to take tests to make it into your if you're going to grad school as a college student, if you're going to make it into grad school, you got to take a test to get into grad school. A lot of times, if you're gonna pass your senior year, a lot of times you have those end of the, what are those called in Texas, the end of the year tests? It's like STAR test or something like that. Is that right? I don't know. I didn't grow up in Oklahoma. In Colorado, we had something totally different. So they're different in every state. But anyways, you have those tests that you gotta finish. And a lot of times, they're not real indicative of everything that you've learned, but it's just part of life. And that's the same way with us as God's people, is that tests are just kind of part of life. And so we've been looking at this story of the people of Israel moving out of Egypt. They've been moving out of Egypt, and they're moving into the wilderness, and they're in this place where everything does not come easily. And the interesting thing about where we are is that we're at the point, we're in chapter 15, we're in chapter 15 where literally their praise is echoing off the rocks because they just experienced the most incredible moment of their history as a people. I mean, there's not many people in the world, in fact, I don't think there are in the history of the world who've experienced what Israel experienced in the 10 plagues and in the Red Sea coming up and washing away the Egyptians. I mean, there are just not many people in the world, in the history of the world, who've experienced something like that. And so they naturally, we talked about this last week, they naturally praised God, and they were you know, singing praises, and they did all these incredible things for God, and they promised, hey, we're going to follow you, we're going to be your people. And their praise is literally echoing off the rocks when they face their first test. In Exodus chapter 15, picking up verse 22, then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the desert of Shur. For 3 days they traveled in the desert without finding water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink its water because it was bitter. That is why the place is called Marah. So their first test is bitter water. Okay, if you know anything about the human body, you know that you've got to have water. I mean, they've gone 3 days without water. Their water supplies are exhausted. They show up at this place that eventually would be called Mira, apparently. It wasn't called that initially. But they got there, and there was water, but it was bitter, meaning that there was some sort of, you know, bacteria in it or something that made it undrinkable or would make people sick. And so they walk up, and they find this water, and it's bitter, and they can't drink it. And so what do the people do 3 days after this incredible praise celebration in the wilderness? What does the newly redeemed people of Israel and the recreated people of Israel do at this moment? Verse 24, so the people grumbled against Moses, saying, what are we to drink? Come on, Moses. And so, of course, Moses turns around and cries out to God and says, God, do something. What are we going to do? We don't have any water. And God reveals a piece of wood that he throws in the water, and it makes the water sweet. And the people drink, and the people have enough to drink and to be healthy. And then after this moment, they move on to the oasis of Elim. And you can read about this in chapter 15, verse 27. They show up, and there's 12 springs of water for the people, and there's 70 palm trees. In other words, there is enough for all 12 tribes. There's enough palm trees for everybody to have great shade. It's a beautiful place. It's an oasis in the wilderness. It's a place that... it's a place that's few and far between in the wilderness, because there's not many places when you're out there that everybody can be supported and everybody can live off the land. And it's beautiful. And while it's nice, it's not the destination, because that's not where they're headed. They're not headed to the oasis of Elim. They're not headed to the place of comfort in the wilderness. They're headed to a promise. And so chapter 16, verse 1, the whole Israelite community set out from Elim, and they come to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had come out of Egypt. So basically, we're 45, 46 days out from Egypt, okay? I mean, that's a little while. And it's at this point that we see test number two, verse 2 of chapter 16. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, if only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. I mean, just imagine what they're saying, how they're saying this. There we sat around pots of meat and we ate all the food we wanted, but you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death. And so you see the second test. Lack of food. They don't have enough food. They don't have what they need. And God's answer is literally to rain down food out of heaven. First thing that happens, quail are blown in and they cover the ground. I mean, this is actually a natural phenomenon that you actually can observe in this place in the ancient Near East. But you can actually observe this today. Quail will be traveling from one body of water to the next, and they literally get to a place in the wilderness where they cannot go on any further, and so they drop to the ground and they have to rest, and they can't fly anymore. And so quail end up covering the entire camp. But the second thing that God does can't be explained naturally. People have tried, it just doesn't hold water. And basically what happens is God rains down manna from heaven. And when the dew dissipates in the morning, there are these little wafers of food that are available on the ground for people to eat. And so God provides for what they need. And after this incredible miracle, after these incredible things, they continue on. Chapter 17, verse 1. The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. And they camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. And so once again, we have a test that involves water, but this time it's not the fact that there's water available, but it's not drinkable. This time, there is no water. There is no water for anybody to drink. And so we would think that the God who can turn bitter water sweet, the God who can rain down food from heaven, the God who can set his people free miraculously from Egypt, the God who can wash away the Egyptians in the Red Sea could be trusted at this point, and they would just trust God, right? Not so. Verse 2. So they quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink. Come on." And Moses replied, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?" Now, many times we read this passage and we really don't understand what this word test means. We don't really understand it. Test means to force God's hand. Test means to force God's hand. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 16, Moses talks about that moment in the wilderness when you, Israel, tried to force God's hand. Remember, Deuteronomy is Moses' speeches before the people enter the promised land. And Moses is actually staying in the wilderness. He's not getting to go because of a sin that he committed. But he's in the wilderness and he's preaching to the people. And he said, "Don't test the Lord your God like you did in the wilderness." In other words, don't force his hand. Jesus talks about this as well in Matthew chapter 4, verse 7, where the devil takes him up to the top of the temple and says, throw yourself off the temple, and surely the angels of God will catch you. And Jesus says, you don't test the Lord your God. You don't force his hand to reveal himself. You don't test the Lord. And so at this point, it's like, well, how are the Israelites testing God? How are they trying to force his hand? And the next verse shows exactly how they're trying to force God's hand. Verse 4, Moses cried out to the Lord, "What am I to do with these people? They're almost ready to stone me." You see what they're doing? They're saying, "Moses, we're going to kill you unless you figure out this problem." I mean, Moses is obviously the chosen person of God. So Moses, we're going to kill you if you don't figure something out. So they're trying to force God's hand by killing God's anointed leader. Okay, they're forcing God's hand. And so God commands Moses to strike a rock and water flows out. Amazing. I mean, just strike a rock and water just boom, you know? It's amazing. I mean, a lot of times we read these stories and we just read over it and it's like we're used to it, especially if you grew up in church. If you did not grow up in church, this is incredible. And some of you may have a hard time believing the things that are talked about here. But many of us who grew up in church, we just take it for granted. So everything is kind of settled down in Rephidim. But then they face their next test. Chapter 17, verse 8. The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. So the fourth test is outside attack. You know, it's kind of interesting to me. A lot of times I think Christians, they live in this world where everybody's trying to attack them and their beliefs. But the reality is that most of the problems, most of the testings that we face are internal. Most of the things that we deal with have to do with what's going on in our community and in our hearts and in who we are and whether we trust God or not. And it's actually kind of rare for the attack to be outside, because the reality is many of us struggle more internally than we do externally, but we try to find the external thing and point to it so that we don't have to look internally. That's just free. That I wouldn't plan on sharing that with you this morning. But outside attack. So Moses has you know, Joshua choose this elite fighting force, and Moses, you know, kind of goes up on the hill to watch it. So Joshua chooses this elite fighting force, and this strange thing happens in the battle. Because as they're fighting, Moses is up there standing on the hill, and he's raising his hands, and they're winning. But then his arms grow fatigued, and he puts them down, and they start to lose. And somebody notices this. Somebody notices that every time Moses' hands are up, they're winning. And when his hands are down, they're losing. And so Aaron, his brother, and Hur, who is Miriam's husband, or Moses' brother-in-law, they pull up a rock and they set Moses on it. And they stand on either side of Moses and they just hold his hands up. And they win the day. I mean, it's this crazy thing. It's like this really weird story. And it's like, what's going on there? And I'm just going to leave you hanging there because we're going to get back to that in a minute. So as I look at these tests in the wilderness, as I look at these things that are going on with the Israelite community, I notice some similarities. And there are probably many more, there could be multiple applications here, but I'm just going to bring out a few similarities that we have with these people. And the first one is that we are a community on the move. See that? I mean, these Israelites are on the move. They are on the move from an act of redemption to a place of promise. God has redeemed them. He has bought them back, and they are headed to a goal. They are headed to a promise that God has said, you will have it. And they were a community on the move. We also are a community on the move. We are moving from an act of past redemption, Jesus dying on the cross, paying for our sins, going up to heaven, being resurrected and going up to heaven, and then him saying, follow me. And surely, I will come back and get you. I will come back and get you. And so we are a people who are on the move. We are going from an act of past redemption to a goal that God has planned for us. That's a similarity. Second one is that present circumstances can cause us to lose our moorings at times. Present circumstances can cause us to lose our moorings, or in other words, the foundation of who we are. Present circumstances can cause us to lose our foundation, our moorings on who we are. So we don't have the resources, or the resources are tainted, or we're suffering attack. You know, and what I mean by that is, you know, like when we're stepping out in faith, guys, we don't ever have exactly what we need. I mean, the church leader, this church knows this internally. If you've been part of Tenth and Broad, you know that this church has stepped out on many occasions, not knowing if we would have what we needed to do to accomplish God's will, and somehow it happens. Somehow it happens. But sometimes the present circumstances, in other words, when we step out in faith and it gets hard, the circumstances can cause us, and the lack of resources can cause us to lose our foundation, to lose who we are. Or maybe we even struggle with the reality that our resources are tainted. How many people here are messed up? Okay, just everybody raise your hand. If you're not raising your hand, I guess you can just polish your halo for a little bit. But here's the thing. We are all messed up people, okay? We are messed up people. We look at ourselves and we see all of our insecurities, all of our selfishness. We see our lusts. We see all the things that we do that are not good. And we think, man, how could God use me? And sometimes we can allow the circumstances of our lives, the mess ups, the messed up, you know, just reality of our lives, just think, man, there's no way God can use this. There's no way that we are truly, you know, God's people. Or maybe I just need to, you know, kind of sit. I just need to show up on church on Sunday morning, and I need to let all the other, you know, saints do the work because I'm just not worthy. But sometimes present circumstances can cause us to lose our moorings. You see, Peter, in his first letter to a struggling congregation in the area north and east of Jerusalem, he writes to a group of churches that are up north and east of Jerusalem, and he reminds them who they are. He says, you are the adopted children of God. You are chosen. You are chosen. You are bought with the precious blood of Christ. You are living stones. You are a holy priesthood. You are a spiritual house. You are the place where people can go and experience God. That's who you are. That's who you are. And we can't allow present circumstances to cause us to lose who we are. That is who God created us to be. And we must take trust and we must believe in that reality, even when the present circumstances point somewhere else. And number three, the wilderness can move beyond a place to a state of mind. The wilderness can move beyond a place to a state of mind. So here's what I mean by that. When you're in the wilderness, things are never right. Things are never right. So we look around at this world and we see that this world is not right. I mean, we see all the badgering back and forth in our political campaigns, and we're like, man, this is not right. We see the terrorism happening in countries. We see the killing. We see the natural disasters that have nothing to do with people, but just this world. We look at the world around us, and it is not right. And so a lot of times we can allow the reality of this wilderness to impact our mind and to allow us to see the world in the broken and messed up way that we see that the world is. But the reality is that this is not who we are. This is not the mind that Christ has called us to. You know, we live in a place where people love to be pessimistic about things and people love to complain, and there's lots of cynicism and there's lots of fear and there's lots of blaming and pointing fingers and fighting. I mean, we see that in churches. And that's exactly what we see in Israel. The wilderness has moved beyond a place to a state of mind. And so sometimes we can be in that place as well. We can allow the wilderness to move beyond just the reality of this world and into our hearts and take away our hope. And so we point fingers and we complain and we have cynicism and we have fear and we blame and we fight because the wilderness has moved beyond the place to a state of mind. So we know we're in the wilderness. I mean, we know that this world is not perfect. We know that this world is not the end all. We know there is something more coming. We are between the promise and fulfillment. And maybe this morning you have lost your moorings, or maybe the present circumstances has caused you to just doubt the reality of who you are in Christ. Or maybe you've just forgotten that we're a community on the move. We are actually moving. We're not to stay static. We're not to stay in the same place. We can't keep doing the same things we've always done and expect it to work, because we are a community on the move. Culture is changing. This world is changing. Technology is changing all around us. All those things are changing. And we cannot stay static. We are on the move from promise to fulfillment. And so what do we do? What do we do in the wilderness? And this is why I love this story so much, because it reveals what a people does when they're in between promise and fulfillment. In the first test, the bitter water, God reveals some sweet wood that would make this water sweet and drinkable. And after that moment, he says this. This is powerful. For Exodus 15, 26. If you listen carefully to the Lord your God and do what is right in his eyes, if you pay attention to his commands and keep all his decrees, I will not bring on you any of the diseases I brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. You see, what we must do is we must trust in the Lord who heals us. We must trust in the Lord who heals us. And you're probably looking at me, and some of you skeptics out there are thinking, well, whoop-de-doo, they say that all the time in church, you know. You got to trust in the Lord. You got to trust in the Lord. Trust in the Lord. But what does that look like? What does that look like? And I think that this story answers and shows what it looks like to trust in the Lord who heals you. The first thing we got to do is we got to know that you will get what you need. We will get what we need. It's not always what we want, right? That's where we struggle. That's where it's like, man, you know, some of us, we have a hard time. There's a pretty, you know, blurry line in between what we want and what we need, at least in our own minds there are. A lot of times somebody else will look at you and they'll say, no, you don't need that, right? You don't need that. You need this. But for many of us, we struggle to distinguish between what it is that we want and what it is that we need. But when we are trusting the God who heals us, know that we will get what we need. Something amazing happens when the Israelites go out to gather the manna. in Exodus chapter 16, something really amazing. So it's like the first day, it's like the new day of manna on the ground, food on the ground. Chapter 16, verse 17, the Israelites did as they were told, and some gathered much and some little. And when they measured it by the omer, the one who gathered much did not have too much, and the one who gathered little did not have too little. Each one had gathered just as much as they needed. You see, God will provide what you need. And the interesting thing is that when they try to hoard it, it gets infested with maggots because they keep it overnight. And God said, don't keep it overnight. But when they keep it overnight, it gets infested with maggots and it rots and it stinks. But it's kind of funny because, but God said on Friday, I want you to gather twice as much and keep it overnight because I don't want you to do anything on the Sabbath. I want you to rest on the Sabbath. And sure enough, when they kept it overnight and they woke up the next morning, it was not maggot infested. It was not rotten. It was still good because God provides what you need. And that leads us to the second way, that this trusting in God, the healing of God works. Verse 22, on the sixth day, they gathered twice as much, two omers for each person, and the leaders of the community came and reported this to Moses. He said to them, this is what the Lord commanded. Tomorrow is to be a day of Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. So bake what you want to bake and boil what you want to boil, save whatever is left and keep it until morning. And this reveals to us the second way that trusting in God looks. It means that we practice Sabbath. Okay, we practice Sabbath. This is one of those ones that we're like, we don't have to do that anymore because we're in the New Testament age. We don't have to, practice Sabbath. But what Sabbath means is that we learn to rest. And here's the reality of the wilderness. And this is why I think you'll see that practicing Sabbath is just as important today as it was then, because there's always something to do in the wilderness. How many people, if you're a leader in the church, you can just look around and see all the stuff that needs to be done. If you're a business owner, you can look around and see all the stuff that needs to be done. If you're a parent, you can see all the things that need to be done around your house and with your kids. If you're a college student, you can look at all the things around, all the things that you can be involved with. There's always something to do, and there's always more to do. That's the reality of the wilderness. When you're in the wilderness, you don't know if you're going to have enough food tomorrow. And so you work and you look for things that you got to get done because you're in the wilderness and nothing is guaranteed. And so we are in the wilderness, but yet God says, rest. That's an important part of trusting in the God who heals us, because he heals us through rest. And finally, you remember the battle of the Amalekites? I told you I'd get back to it. So Joshua picks his men, his elite fighting force, but that's not what wins the battle. It's not what wins the battle. When Moses' hands are raised, they win. When they're lowered, they lose. I've never read this in a commentary, and I really haven't heard an explanation for this, so I'm telling you, I'm going out on a limb here. But I just want to suggest something. Because when you look at the meaning of raised hands in the ancient world, even in our world, when you raise your hands, it is a sign of supplication. It is a sign of reverence. It is a sign that whoever you are raising your hands to, they are in control of your outcome. And so I just want to suggest something, that when Moses was in a posture of reverence and supplication, they won. But when he brought his hands down because he was too tired, he was no longer in that posture, and therefore they lost. And this is what I think that truly trusting in the God who provides healing is, that we live in reverence and supplication to God. We live in reverence, we worship, and we ask for him to act up upon our behalf. And he is the one that matters. It is his power. It is not our elite fighting force. It is not the staff of this church that's going to make this church succeed. You know, it's not the dream team. It's not the new set of elders. It's not the set of deacons. It's not the set of, Bible class teachers. It's not the set of base group leaders that's going to make M4C successful. It is the power of God, and it is his people revering and submitting to him that makes us successful. And finally, in the wilderness, we must remember that difficulties and hardships do not equal God's absence. We must remember. And the opposite is also true. Because we're having a great run, because everything is going well, it doesn't mean that God is necessarily with us. I mean, those aren't good gauges. You know, when we're facing difficulties and hardships, we always seem to question God's presence and whether God is around or whether God is working. But difficulties and hardships do not equal God's absence. And just because we spend some time in Elam, in the oasis, in the place where there is enough for everybody, and just because we're in a place where everything is going well, it does not mean that necessarily that God is pleased with us. That's just the reality of this world. Sometimes things are good, sometimes things are bad, but God is always with us in the wilderness. And sadly, we are often tempted to give God ultimatums. And we oftentimes are tempted to kind of, you know, just test God and try to force his hand. Well, God, if you can answer this prayer, I'll follow you. But if you don't, I'm done. You can always find something to grumble about. You can always find something to be upset about. You can always find somebody to point a finger at. And you can always look at a direction that is chosen and figure out a way that it's not very good. That's just the reality of the wilderness. We do not have all the answers. We do not know perfectly everything that God wants us to do to live out the gospel in this city, in this world. We just don't know. We don't have that perfect information. But we do have the goal. And we do have the strategy. We have the mission to accomplish. And so what if we, the 10th and Broad Church of Christ, what if we would see ourselves as people on the move? What if we would realize that we never arrive until we are in heaven? What if we would see ourselves as people who are constantly growing and changing and adapting and adjusting to the reality of the wilderness around us? What if we saw ourselves as people on the move? And what if we trusted in the God who heals us through the difficulties and the hard times? What if we realize that God was with us, whether we were facing hard times or good times, God is with us. And whether we're facing hard times or good times, it doesn't mean God is any more with us or less with us. And here's what I think is going to happen in this church if we can live like this. Joy will be unleashed in our lives, in our families, in our church, and in our community. Because when we are not dependent upon the circumstances of the wilderness and we instead are dependent upon all-powerful Creator God, we can be joyful anywhere. This is exactly what Paul was talking about when he said, I've learned the secret of being content, whether I have everything I need or whether I don't have anything. I can do this through the power and the strength that comes through Christ. I believe optimism will spread like a disease in this church. Instead of thinking about all the reasons why we don't like what's going on, or if we can always come up with somebody to be upset about. I don't like the worship leader. I don't like the preacher. I don't like, you know, the Bible class teacher. Instead of thinking about all these things that we don't like, we can instead allow optimism and give people the benefit of the doubt, because you know what? God's working through them. And God's working through you. God wants to work through you. But when we look at everything as, and we allow the wilderness to infiltrate our minds, God is unable to work through you. Because we are constantly grumbling and we are constantly complaining about what's going on. When we live and trust God, when we realize that we are people on the move, optimism will spread like a disease, and our community will become a contagious community that causes this world to just kind of lean in, say, what's different? What's different about these people? You know, that guy walks into church. I mean, you know, the boss just said all these horrible things to him, and he just loves them anyway. Or, you know, this person is struggling with all these things that are going, you know, there's death, there's loss, there's destruction in their life, and somehow they're different. And the reality is that when we live this way, Joy will be unleashed, optimism will spread like a disease, and our community will become a contagious community that causes the world to lean in and wonder what's different about us and consider who we follow. Consider Jesus. So let's journey together. Let's worship.